Good afternoon, everyone. It's Peter Fullerton, Vice President Branch Manager with the Harbour Group here in Toronto. We've got the pleasure of having Robin Gullison giving us his fall 2014 update. His report was recently posted to our website. You can access it there. I'll pass the floor over to Robin, and I'll close up at the end with a few questions. Robin.
Great. Thanks, Peter. Good afternoon, everybody. First off, thanks for taking the time to join us today. As Peter mentioned, I'm going to go through our fall 2014 market update. And when we're done, Peter will ask me a couple of questions we've noticed are on the mind of a lot of our clients. So whenever I do these things, I like to first kind of take a bit of a step back and look where we've been and then figure out where we're going. And if you look back to this year, you had a weak start to the year that was driven by mostly bad weather. And at the time, people were skeptical. They said, oh, is it really because of just snow or is it more than that? And it turns out, you know, we've had a pretty nice bounce back in economic activity. And I think it's fair to say it was weather-related, and now you've got a fairly good trajectory of growth going on. When you look at things like the employment numbers, the manufacturing surveys, et cetera, all look pretty good. And when you look at this recovery in general, one of the big complaints, of course, has been that it's been a weak recovery in economic growth. And we're at about the five-year point right now since the recession, and it's been about 5 years of a bull market. And that, on average, is how long these cycles last. So now is the time when you get a lot of the naysayers coming out and saying, oh, that's it. You got the average length. You know, this is just a countdown until it's all over. But I think we have to remember a couple of things. Number one, an average is an average. It encompasses a bunch of different numbers, and it just happens to be the one that is the average of all the outcomes, right? And if you look at this cycle, it's been a much weaker than average cycle, so we think it'll probably go on a bit longer. So right now we're about 20 quarters since the recession. And in the United States, you've had cumulative GDP growth of all of 10% of real GDP growth, so about 2% a year, so nothing too stunning. You know, historically, you'd probably be about double that by now, so you'd have 20% growth in the bottom or, you know, almost 4% per year. So even though this cycle is at the average length, it's been nowhere near the average intensity, and because of that, a lot of the excesses that tend to build up and lead to recessions aren't present. For example, right now, you don't have really tight labor market. In the U.S., you've got an unemployment rate in the 6% range. It's getting better, but it's nowhere near tight. And you also have inflation that's pretty low. It's starting to pick up again, but again, it's still fairly low. And we're not seeing a lot of excesses really in the markets. Maybe a couple exceptions, you know, in the internet sectors earlier this year, or some parts of the fixed income markets are a little bit exuberant, but nothing really widespread. And what usually leads to recession, of course, is that you have tight money. So you have central banks seeing inflation percolating, seeing speculative activity. They start to push on the brakes a little bit. So they start to raise interest rates. Eventually, they raise interest rates to the point where short-term rates are higher than long-term rates. They call that an inverted yield curve. And at that point, you're just waiting for a recession. Because once you've got short-term rates higher than long-term rates, it's not a much of an incentive for banks to lend. That slows down economic activity, and you have to put the recession. But where are we today? Well, we've got a U.S. central bank who's still printing money, although they're slowing down, and talking about maybe perhaps raising rates sometime next year. We've got a Canadian central bank who says they're likely to raise rates after the U.S. starts, so they're further behind than them, though we're already at 1% versus zero. And you've got other central banks in the world, the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank, that are still fairly aggressive in their stimulative monetary policies. So we think because it's been a weaker cycle and you haven't had these excesses build up, the cycle probably lasts a little bit longer than average, so it doesn't mean it's necessarily all over right now. The recession indicators we look at do not really show any strong probability of a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. And if we look at, again, just a few employment indicators, so employment in the U.S. is now the highest it's been since the last recession, so you finally took out the old highs in employment. You're at new highs in the amount of employment. You've averaged about 200,000 a month of non-farm payrolls in the U.S. this year, so you're starting to see, finally, these later stage indicators start to kick in, because, again, the lack of employment growth is one of the big problems this cycle. Well, that's finally started to kick in, and you're starting to see improvements there as the unemployment rate comes down. And if we switch gears to the markets, again, we like to kind of figure out where we are and then determine where we're going, and one of the quotes we like to look at this is from Sir John Templeton. It says, bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. So where are we today? Well, the pessimism stage is long past. That's probably March 2009. That's kind of the end of the world. Nobody wants to touch any stocks. People just want to hold tight onto their cash and bonds. The skepticism phase is kind of more like people don't believe it. The market's going up, but the vast majority of people don't believe it. That probably takes you through to 2011, 2012, when you had the European debt crisis. And we think once Mr. Draghi in 2012 kind of put an end to things, saying that he'd do whatever it takes to save the euro, and the U.S. politicians stopped fooling around with the debt ceiling, et cetera, that probably puts you through the optimism phase where we find ourselves now. We don't think we're quite at euphoria yet. That's when you're starting to see extraordinary valuations on equities. You're starting to see mega mergers taking place. You're seeing the stock market on general interest publications, and you're starting to see, you know, your cab driver giving you stock tips. That's not where we think we are right now. We think we're still in this optimism phase. Again, probably past the halfway point, but we don't think we're quite at the end yet. So as long as this stays the case, we think the risk-reward favors the equity market over the bond market, because we think bond market is fairly expensive, and we'll get to that in just a minute. One of the biggest questions we're getting from clients is there a correction on the horizon? And it's a fair question. In the U.S. stock market, you've gone about 1,075 days since there's been a 10% correction. That's quite a long time. Not the longest. I think the longest is actually over 2,000 days in the 1990s, so there's many different time periods that have taken place without a correction, but it's definitely worthy of taking notes. So we got our colleagues in head office to run some numbers and said, well, what does an average correction look like? So we broke it down to three kinds. This is the data going back to 1945. You've got your mild corrections, 5 to 10% down, an intermediate correction, 10 to 20% down, and a bear market, which is down 20% plus. So we've had, in that time period, 56 of these mild corrections, 19 intermediate corrections, and 10 bear markets. And we're going to focus on the mild correction, because that's kind of your run-of-the-mill market correction. That's what has the highest probability of happening. And that's what I think most people are focused on, because, again, we haven't had a 10% yet. So what does that typically look like on average? Well, your average decline is 7%. The decline on average is over peak to trough in 1 month. And then 2 months later, you're typically back where you started. So while you're going through this, it's obviously fairly uncomfortable, and it's something people like to time if they could, but the timing of this is actually really challenging, because you have to think, number one, are we going to sell it at the exact top when it feels really good? Number two, are we going to sell at the bottom of it when it kind of feels pretty bad? And number three, of course, you're going to give up your dividend income all the way through that time period. So in our view, these mild corrections are kind of the price of admission to playing in the equity market. That's why investors expect higher returns than they do in other asset classes, because you're going to live with this volatility. So even though, again, while you're going through it, it's not the most comfortable, we think that it's a pretty run-of-the-mill event. It's very likely to happen at some point, but trying to predict it is pretty hard. You know, you could have a geopolitical event or other things could happen. What we really worry about is bear markets. That's down 20% plus. That's obviously much more painful. And for that, we look at the outlook for recession, because bear markets are almost exclusively due to recessions. And again, as I mentioned earlier, we don't really see that on the near-term horizon. And looking again at the seasonal period we're in right now, we're starting to hear a lot of market pundits talk about how it's the fall. And the fall is typically the weakest time for the market. Everybody thinks October is the cruelest month, but it's actually September, on average, has the lowest return for the equity market. It's the only month where you've got a greater than 50% chance of a down month in the S&P 500. It's only 53%, so it's a bit of a coin toss, but people like to focus on these things. And we think the interesting thing this time is that you've got this weak fall period countered by a very strong part of what they call the presidential cycle. So a lot of analysts out there will look at the market in four-year chunks based around the U.S. presidential election cycle. And right now, we're going into the third year of the presidential cycle. So right now is the second year, it's the midterm election year, and next year is the third year. And for whatever reason, the fall of the midterm elections to the spring of the third year of the presidential cycle is extraordinarily strong. There's many reasons people posit for this. Some people think that the Federal Reserve isn't going to tighten interest rates as much as they otherwise would, because they don't want to be seen as politically meddling. Others think that the president starts to enact more economically friendly policies as they start to gear up for either their re-election or the election of somebody from their party. So whatever the reason is, the numbers are pretty staggering. Going back to the 1960s, in this period, October 1st of the midterm year to April 30th of the third year, the S&P 500 is up on average 21% with only one down year, and is only down 80 basis points that year. And we looked at the TSX as well, because the two markets are fairly highly correlated. The TSX on average is up 16.8% with only one down year as well. So while we're coming up to this weak seasonal period, September, October are typically fairly weak, we think you're kind of countered by this presidential cycle that's coming up. So it's something to keep in mind. If we do see some weakness here in the next week or month, we have to remember that, you know, the batting average for this presidential cycle is pretty strong. It's obviously not the only thing we use in our asset allocation. But we kind of have to pay respect to a strong track record like this. Moving on with valuations in the market right now, if you look at the forward price earnings ratio, so that's the earnings analysts are expecting for next year out of the stock market to today's price, you're basically where you were in the middle of last cycle. You're kind of in that 16 times range. So the stocks aren't dirt cheap like they were in 2011, 2012, and you were kind of around 12 times. But you're just above the long-term average and exactly where you were in the middle of the range last cycle. So we don't think valuations are all that challenging. Our view has been this year that it's going to be more about more about earnings growth than price earnings expansion. So last year, the market was up fairly sizably. Most of that was due to people paying more for stock. So the price earnings ratio went up a lot more than earnings went up. This year, we thought it would be all about earnings growth and expecting obviously a little more tepid growth and return than last year, and that's been the story this year, particularly in the U.S. It's been all about earnings growth. The earnings growth's up about 6-7% year to date, plus you've gotten a dividend of about 2, and the PE multiple hasn't really changed that much. So our view is if we can capture 6-7% earnings growth, grab that dividend of around 2%, that puts you in the high single digits. And if we do get multiple expansion, well, that's kind of a bonus for us. We're not going to make that our base case. I think that's a little too aggressive. But if we can just get the earnings growth plus the dividends, we think that's a fairly good return after what we saw last year. Some of the other positives we're seeing is that the quality of earnings growth is getting a lot better. One of the big complaints this cycle has been that you haven't seen a lot of top-line revenue growth, so companies aren't selling more units of whatever it is they produce. It's been all about financial engineering, so cutting costs, laying people off, issuing bonds to buy back stock to make the earnings per share look better, all those sorts of things have been very prevalent. The last quarter, we finally started to see revenue growth coming a bit stronger. So revenue growth for the S&P 500 last quarter was about 4.5%. That compares to 3% the quarter before, so a nice acceleration. And you're finally getting that revenue growth in line with where the economy is growing. So if you think the economy, we call it nominal GDP, which is real GDP growth plus inflation, if that's running in the 4% range, 2% growth, and 2% inflation, if you can get revenue growth over 4%, that's a pretty good outcome. So we're pretty encouraged that we're starting to see a lot better quality of how the earnings are coming through as opposed to just financial engineering, because that really can't go on forever. Another big theme this year has been very low volatility. So if people look at things like the VIX, which is the popular measure of equity market volatility, if you look at volatility in the bond market or in the currency markets, although the currency markets have gotten a lot more volatile the last couple of weeks, it's been pretty low. And there's a lot of reasons for this. Probably the chief among them is that, again, central bankers are kind of, investors have the view that central bankers have their back. So whenever you've got some sort of sell-off in the last few years, you've always had the central bankers step in. So that's drained volatility from the market quite a bit. We kind of look forward and say, well, what could disrupt this? So what could A, cause volatility to increase, and B, cause that correction everybody seems to be waiting for? And aside from a geopolitical event that we can't really predict, we think a change in the interest rate outlook could be one of them. Historically, when you start to get close to the first rate hike from the Federal Reserve, you start to see volatility in the equity market. And that makes sense because if you think of the cycle we've had zero rates for over five years now. So a lot of money out there is invested on the thesis that interest rates at the short end of the curve are going to stay very low or zero for a while yet, and that's how people make their decisions. And a lot of money is probably leveraged to finance that very short-term interest rate near zero and investing it elsewhere. So that starts to change. That changes the calculus for a lot of investors. So once you start to see rate hikes on the horizon, we'll probably see some sort of volatility in the market. Does that get us a 10% correction? Who knows? But I think the bigger thing to think about is what happens after that. And as long as the economy continues to come through and you get growth, typically the market recovers and keeps going. So the first few rate hikes, once those are out of the way and the economy keeps going stronger, typically the equity market does well, and that's when the bond market starts to suffer historically. Looking at the bond market, we think that the 30-year bull market in bonds is probably ended in 2012 when you hit 1.6% on 10-year treasuries. It doesn't mean we're going to see, you know, 5-6% on 10-year bonds anytime soon, but we think historical rates of return will be pretty hard to achieve. And first off, let's say there's a big difference between a bad year in the bond market and a bad year in the stock market, right? Last year was a bad year in the bond market. Interest rates almost doubled for some maturities. And if you had a broad Canadian index investment, you would have lost a grand total of 1.27% with your reinvested coupon. So that's not really that big of a deal considering what you can lose in equities in a bad year. Let's say you had only long-term bonds, that was a little more painful. You were off about 6% with your reinvested interest. The price only was down about 10%, so that's a little bit more risky, but I don't think a lot of our clients have a ton of long-term interest rate exposure. We think the biggest risk for people is that investors extrapolate historical returns at the bond market, which have been very strong, and try to count on those going forward. Because for the last 20-plus years, in a broad bond index, you probably return in the 6% plus range fairly easily. But going forward, to achieve that kind of return year after year is almost mathematically impossible. The studies we've done indicate that your best estimator of your forward fixed income return is the current bond yield, even if interest rates change going forward. So right now, on a diversified bond portfolio, you're looking somewhere in the twos. So we think it's pretty hard to earn more than that over the next few years on a year-over-year basis, for years in a row. Sure, one year, like this year, you've had a good move in interest rates, but that just borrows return from the next year. So we think, again, the risk isn't so much that people see huge volatility in their bond portfolio. It's more that they aren't going to earn the returns they may have based their assumptions on going forward. And looking at the fixed income market, one of the big questions, of course, is why are yields so low right now? You do have decent growth in North America. You do have inflation around 2%. So 6 months ago, people worried about deflation. Now you're basically at the central bank's targets. One of the big things is that European interest rates, this may sound surprising to a lot of people, but European interest rates are actually very low. German 10-year bond yields are at about 1% right now, while you've got the U.S. 10-year bond yield at about 2.5% and Canada at around 2%. Meanwhile, the euro has been depreciating. So if you're a European investor, investing in U.S. treasuries has actually been a really good trade because you've gotten a higher interest rate and you've captured that currency depreciation. So while we think yields should trend higher just based on fundamentals, you have to think about the technical aspect and how money flows look around the world. So until those German rates start to go higher, we think you probably stay at fairly low interest rates, but the risk, of course, is that they start to go higher. And when we look at interest rates, we think, well, what's the fair value? Again, we think on a 10-year bond, if you're at the 3.5% to 4%, that's probably pretty fair value. It feels like it's a long way away from where we are right now, and again, the twos to mid-twos. But back in 2011, we were at that 3.5, 3.75 for 10-year U.S. Treasuries. Canada was a bit lower. So to us, that doesn't seem that far-fetched. And at those kind of levels, we probably get a little more interested in fixed income. And how does this apply to people's equity portfolios? Well, we look at 2013 as a great case study. What happens when you have an unexpected rise in longer-term interest rates? So, of course, short-term interest rates didn't change, but long-term interest rates went up quite substantially. And we looked at all the different sectors in the TSX and what performed well and what didn't. And the companies that performed well were companies that had leverage to either higher interest rates or stronger growth. So these are things like life insurance, industrials, banks, and energy, things that did poorly were securities that had more of a bond-type characteristic, so high cash flow, slower growth. So things like telecom, the REITs, again, all these businesses that are based on their yield and not so much on their ability to grow their dividend. So in our view, what's your best playbook for rising interest rates? Well, we think that companies that have the potential to grow their dividend are likely to do better as rates go higher. It doesn't necessarily mean they pay a high dividend yield, but it's more about the growth. And if we think of it this way, if you have a security or you have a required yield that changes with the bond market, and right now you need a 3% yield, but if bond rates go up 100 basis points or 1%, your requirement goes to 4%. Let's base this on $100 security. If you have a security that's paying you $3, so a 3% yield on 100, and all of a sudden your yield requirement goes to 4, well, therefore the price of that security has to go down until that yield equals 4%. Alternatively, you can have the cash flow grow, right? So if your $3 turns into $4 in income, theoretically the price doesn't have to change as much. So we think dividend growth is a good strategy for people concerned about higher interest rates, whereas a high dividend yield strategy might be a little more challenging in its total return. Doesn't mean you're not going to get the cash flow you expect, but it might have more of a sensitivity to changes in the bond market. So that's it for me. I think Peter's got a couple of questions.
Great. That's an amazing amount of insight in a short period of time, Robin. Thank you very much. A lot of our clients have assets and or liabilities in U.S. dollars. What do you see for the Canadian dollar?
The Canadian dollar has had a pretty volatile year. It's pretty funny. We started the year at around 94 cents, and we got halfway through the year, and you're basically back there. You did a round trip down to 89 cents. You ended at 94. Today we see ourselves kind of at around 91, I think a little lower than that today. And I think the big determinant on that is two things. Number one, commodity prices are under pressure. And number two, the Bank of Canada has basically told us they're likely to raise interest rates after the U.S. does. And the interest rate differential, so the difference on yield you get in Canada versus the U.S., and more importantly, the change in that is a pretty important determinant of currencies. So while the Canadian dollar is fairly low right now, it's actually still overvalued on a fundamental basis. And we think the risk is it goes lower. Now, if we get a turnaround in commodities, or we get some indication that the Bank of Canada is thinking of raising rates before the U.S., that'd be good for the Canadian dollar, and you'd probably get a rally. But we think over the medium term, the risk is to the downside because you've got commodities that are fairly weak, and you've got a U.S. central bank that at this point looks like they're going to raise interest rates ahead of Canada. If that changes, that would change the outlook for the Canadian dollar.
Good. The other question that is timely is the interest rates on cash savings and GICs very low right now. Any change on the horizon?
Well, that definitely has to do with, I guess, there's a couple of factors there. The cash rate on high interest savings accounts, et cetera, is really dependent on what the Bank of Canada does. That's probably not going to change for the next year, maybe a little bit more, because, again, the Bank of Canada has so far told us they're probably going to be behind the U.S., and the U.S. probably isn't going to raise rates until the first or second quarter of next year. So on those short-term rates, probably not a lot of relief in the near term. GIC rates, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years out are a bit different. Right now, GICs are actually one of the best deals you can get as a high-quality fixed-income investor. You know, it doesn't feel like these rates are that attractive, but when you compare it to a high-quality corporate bond or government bond, the rates are actually pretty good. And that's because the banks are kind of competing for these deposits to fund mortgages and things like that. So they're competing for investors' money, and whoever pays the highest rate tends to get the money. So that's going to be driven more by, you know, if we do see a big sell-off in bonds and rates go a lot higher on comparable securities, I think the GIC rates will go up. And if you see certain banks that are really competitive and need money, they'll pay an above-market rate for a short period of time to get that money, and that's something we do watch for clients and stay on top of pretty regularly.
Thanks, Robin. Well, that'll do it for our call today. I do encourage you to give any of us a call here at the Harbor Group, 416-842-2300, and or go to our website, theharborgroup.com, to look at some of Robin's material. We also send out Robin's material periodically on an email list, so feel free to give us a call and add your email to that list. Thanks for joining us, and have a great afternoon. Bye.